Welcome to the ANews podcast. This is episode 20 for July 15th, 2017. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. Editorial. Islamic State is not the existential enemy of anarchists. This past week has witnessed the fall of Mosul, a major center of Islamic State power in Iraq, to an array of state and semi-state armed forces, as well as an ongoing battle by the U.S., Russia, Syrian state, and Kurdish forces for the city of Raqqa in Syria. Accompanying these conflicts has been a flood of anarchist cheerleading as the Islamic State, which has been presented as an existential threat to all things good, i.e. the Kurds, appears to be folding or at least displaced from the power it held previously. Though people seem a bit more circumspect about Mosul, the Kurds involved there being the wrong kind, and also the high number of reported civilian deaths, perhaps, Raqqa really has those green and yellow flags flying. As with most flag-waving, this most recent round has also left a bad taste in my mouth. The construction of narratives about existential threats and the heroes who stand against them is useful for building a collective identity to mobilize around a cause. This is something understood by both the state and anti-fascists alike, but it's not particularly good for critical thinking. We could ask, for example, why among the many combatants in Syria, it's the Islamic State, and to a lesser extent Turkey, that have attracted so much wrath from anarchists as to be labeled fascists who must be crushed at all costs, rather than the Assad government, the U.S., or Iran. What differentiates these forces, besides the fact that some are fighting against the Kurds while others are actively supporting them and working alongside them, if only for the time being? And for that matter, when did the YPG and Rojava become synonymous with anarchy? To me, this speaks in part to the complication with international solidarity as is often practiced by anarchists. Though we may think we know better, the tendency to look for heroes and forces of good with a capital G is no less endemic among us than it is among the left. Thus, we see such absurdities as the claim that Rojava is the living embodiment of anarchy in our time, and David Graeber praising his tour of the police department there. It is true that underneath all the propaganda, many boosters of the YPG seem at least somewhat aware that the continued existence of Kurds in the region has been in part due to their willingness to align themselves with some powers that be against others. But all of the bad stuff, the jails, governance, alliances with various powers, can be dismissed as rough edges or folded into the category of revolutionary realism, and all of this defended with a pithy, quote, "Well, what kind of revolution are you making?" unquote. As opposed to this idealism, I agree with Monsieur Dupont that, quote, "Anarchists' proper political task is to poke their fingers into the wounds of revolution, to doubt and to look for ways in which the Zapatistas, FLN, ANC, or any other bunch of left-wing heroes will sell out, because they always do sell out," unquote. The battle for Raqqa just showcases the fact that the YPG has already sold out as, years after ducking out from the wider armed conflict with Assad in return for self-governance, they now fight alongside some of the most monstrous forces in the world today, and they will continue to sell out as long as they think it can assure them a territory in northern Syria. And while for various reasons I would hesitate to tell people in Rojava how they should be living, I would be equally reluctant to even call that kind of thing ideal, much less anarchy.
Hey, this is a new song. We call this one Heroes and Villains.
What's new this week? An open letter to liberals and progressives from the Black Bloc, from It's Going Down. An appeal to non-radicals to join the club. To the same effect, but not as pithy as the quote by Martin Niemöller about who they came for first and then what happened.
Greece releases jailed anarchist writer Tassos Theophilou. Another piece from Al Jazeera, with a lot of information on the case of Theophilou, with the bottom line that he was found innocent. Quote, "In February 2014, Theophilou was first sentenced to 25 years in prison after being found guilty of robbing a bank and killing a taxi driver on the Greek island of Paros in August of 2012. For half a decade, he rejected the charges against him, and many Greek activists considered him a political prisoner due to his involvement in the anarchist movement. Unquote.
The Man in Black, interview with Russian anarchist Dmitry Buchenkov. From opendemocracy.net, which has the tagline, Russia and Beyond, and says about itself, quote, Open democracy seeks to challenge power and encourage democratic debate across the world with human rights as our central guiding focus, unquote. This is an interview with a Russian anarchist who was framed for a crime when he was demonstrably somewhere else. It offers a first-person account of life in a Russian prison, sounds pretty familiar to hear, and he's an example of someone whose prison experience is validating his political outlook. Quote, On the whole, I have a profound antipathy for the state system of the Russian Federation. Not for the country as such, I must emphasize, but for the bureaucratic system, which has impudently taken upon itself to speak on behalf of the entire people. My thoughts vis-a-vis the workings of this system have been confirmed in practice. I'm currently writing a book in which I expound the results of my observations. It represents an idiosyncratic attempt to analyze Russia's investigative and judicial systems from the point of view of political sociology. Unquote.
Water Cannons versus the Black Bloc, the story of the G20 protests. This article starts out with an embarrassing factual error, which A-News commenters were quick to correct, and goes on to name the water cannon as a decisive factor in defanging G20 protests. This does not count as sympathetic to anarchists, and there are plenty of other more anarchist-friendly sources. But here's a quote anyway. Quote, Demonstrators and police settled into a routine. Black-clad protesters would gather, drawing the police, who'd be met by rocks and bottles from other protesters nearby. Then a different group of police would flank the other protesters and charge into the crowd, knocking people down and raining baton blows on anyone suspected of throwing a rock or a bottle. Arrests seemed rare, with police preferring to spend their energies on maneuvering to keep the protesters from joining up with one another. Unquote.
Italy. Update on Operation Scripta Manent and a few comments. From Greek site tracesoffire.espivblogs.net comes this bad news about an Italian state investigation into Croce Nera Anarchica and Radio Azione. Quote, After 5 years of fictive control on January 10th, the Public Prosecutor's Office of Naples demanded an arrest for me, the comrade of Radio Azione in Croatia, and two other Greek comrades, one of which is already imprisoned for CCF. What are we accused of? Providing counter-information through websites and magazines, translation of claims of responsibility from across the world, of support, solidarity, and complicity with anarchist comrades Alfredo Cospita and Nicola Gai, raising money for imprisoned comrades, and of having created an Italian-Croatian-Greek cell of FAI, unquote.
The Four Tenets of Anarcho-Homicidalism. This is a pro-violence excerpt from an upcoming book posted on a blog apparently for VGM Publishing in New Zealand with books on the Maori language, cannabis activism, using psychology to write, etc. Quote, Anarcho-homicidalism is a radical new philosophy that is rapidly challenging people's conceptions of what is possible within political space. Unquote. Sounds like an excuse for militias, but then so do many things.
Ex-diplomat Carney Ross, The Case for Anarchism. From British paper The Guardian, this describes the anarchist creep, both in the growing acceptance of the word anarchist and of the meaning of anarchist to be more or less constrained to believer in direct democracy. Quote, In fact, anarchist ideas are taking root everywhere from Grenfell Tower to Rojava, the Kurd-run area of northern Syria. Anarchism is a political outlook rooted in the notion of direct democracy, a polity in which power moves from the bottom upwards. Many of those protesting at the Grenfell Tower fire argue that it was a symptom of a politics that goes in the other direction, from the uncaring top down to the unheard bottom. Ross not only wants to reverse what he sees as a failed kind of democracy, but believes the crisis of, quote, neoliberalism has created the conditions in which people are beginning to voice their disapproval of the status quo, unquote.
Free speech, democracy, and repressive tolerance. From Anarchismo by Wayne Price. Here Price defends pure tolerance, rejecting the argument in Marcuse's essay, Repressive Tolerance, published in the book Critique of Pure Tolerance. Marcuse seems to have been attempting to say that context matters, and the agenda of, quote, peace, justice, and freedom for all, unquote, deserves violent and proactive defense. Price appropriately notes that this requires, especially when everyone claims to be acting in defense of those principles, someone to determine what the agenda looks like. Quote, The libertarian democratic tradition accepts that people are limited and fallible. The truth can never be known with absolute certainty, but only approximated, to the best of human ability at any one time. Therefore, there must be free speech and opinion, letting differing views be expressed, clash with one another, and influence each other. As expressed opinions interact with actual human experience, a truer and more useful set of ideas will emerge over time. Unquote. Since Marcuse is apparently saying, among other things, that free speech is an abstraction that can act against itself and that democracy can be used to repress, and Price is saying that we each have to make this decision for ourselves, and that more information is usually better for decision-making, this seems to me to be one of those irritating situations where both opponents are right, but I haven't read the Marcuse essay, so maybe Price missed something.
12th Annual Victoria Anarchist Book Fair. This is the announcement of the dates of this book fair, which are September 16th and 17th. These are the same days as the Bay Area Book Fair and Bastard Conference. Quote, "We seek to challenge colonial attitudes, introduce anarchism to the public, foster dialogue between various political traditions, and create radical, inclusive, anti-oppressive spaces." Unquote.
Anarchists, intersectionality, races, Islamophobia, etc. The Anarchist Library provides this piece, translated by Jesse Cohn, from a French anarchist site, grand-angle-libertaire.net, that is a conversation between two author professors on race and privilege, at least in France. Quote, "A controversy surrounding the use of the term race has emerged in anarchist circles in France. Those who use such a notion are called racialist and likened to racists. This particularly affects the concept of intersectionality that comes from the social sciences and has been taken up by activists in order to better articulate our thoughts about different forms of oppression, such as gender, race, and class. Recently, the anarchist group Regard Noir, Black Gaze, since voluntarily dissolved, published with the Anarchist Federation a pamphlet titled Class, Genre, Race, et Anarchisme, Class, Gender, Race, and Anarchism, featuring translations of short texts from the Women's Caucus of the British Anarchist Federation, which helped to reflect on the concept and the phenomenon of privileges. Grand Angle, Wide Shot, a site for anarchist discussion, wished to propose a conversation among anarchists and social scientists to clear up certain misunderstandings and compare the French and Quebecois activist and intellectual contexts." Unquote. There are some interesting and provocative comments in the thread on ANews.
How to Start a Fire, an anonymous submission. This is a treatise on how to address the collapse of civilization. It has some controversial suggestions. Quote, "In the attempt to build a life in common, we are confronted immediately by limits imposed by the capitalist economy of jobs, rent, and unfavorable housing. That comrades and friends are compelled to work is a sign of profound weakness. This is a collective problem that should be treated seriously. Work must be rendered voluntary, a tactical or strategic consideration. A pleasure, not a necessity for survival. Of course, the most pressing expense is nearly always rent. It keeps us working and needlessly vulnerable to the whims of landlords, emergencies, and city planners. Comrades should organize to purchase housing as soon as possible. It's cheaper than renting and provides us with greater permanence and therefore strategic insights to the conflicts around us." Unquote.
G20, Thoughts on the Summit Clashes. From long-standing English publication Project Freedom, this analysis of the G20 conflict draws on previous articles by radical and liberal sources and notes two schools of thought on summit confrontations. Quote, "One, often with a more insurrectionary bent, looks upon events such as these as key to the process of building direct action dissent, violent or no, as a norm and mobilizing particularly the young to break with the stifling process of growing up and old under state and capital. The other is less enamored of the summit-hopping spectacle, arguing that while such breaks offer adrenaline and excitement, inspiring some, they often divide and alienate others. They provide a sort of training experience for the forces of control and a boogeyman for the elites to foist on the populace. They certainly aren't events at which everyone can attend or feel safe. Both are, to a more or lesser extent and according to circumstance, true." Unquote.
Two alleged anarchists to stand trial for North Philly vandalism spree. Mainstream media article about two folks popped for some destructive activity. Extremely unsympathetic coverage, which of course is what we should expect. Might give some tips on what not to do.
First, a symbol of Occupy Wall Street, then he waded into Syria. Another article from the New York Times on Robert Grote, who was killed while in Syria fighting for the YPG, the article doesn't weigh in much, briefly sketching his trajectory from California participant in the New York Occupy to father to YPG volunteer.
For a community that can overcome trauma and defeat repression, an anonymous submission to A-News, this is a first-person thoughtful account of the psychological impact of state repression, defined here as, quote, an individual's direct or passive encounter with governing institutions or agents that deal with investigating, charging, or punishing an individual for their political, subversive, or controversial interests, associates, or actions, unquote. It correctly notes that as anarchists, we have to be more prepared for this kind of attention and punishment from the state, and suggests a more nuanced understanding of what makes some people talk to the state. It is also explicit about some of the consequences, not to scare people, but to inform us of what we could be in for. Quote, other than having a few critical years of my life taken away due to my choices as a self-proclaimed anarchist, I have dealt with about 10 years of direct posturing and confusing threats by the state. The confusion I refer to is that, for so many years, they have not known who I really am. They just visited people and places they associated with projects they thought I was doing, like a ratchet ghost haunting me. This anonymity was actually a benefit of being taught to take seriously security culture. Throughout the years of this poking and fishing, and to the second that I write this, I don't fear punishment for a crime I have committed. When my mind races, I am stressed to live with the reality that at any moment I risk punishment for simply the expression of my desires in writing, and my commitment to demonstrating no will toward their requested cooperation. I am referring to the possibility of a grand jury. Unquote.
The Russian Revolution of 1917, the Dada Counterpoint. From Autonomies for anyone who likes Dada. If you've never heard of it or doubt its connection to anarchist thought, this is a good start. Quote, for Dada, there was first the primal scream of horror and refusal of a world set out on mass murder in the name of patriotism and civilization. Adrift in the lying longaria of states, cultural authorities, newspapers, language had ceased to be meaningful in the massacres of the trenches of the First World War. Its intentional destruction was now the only means to reveal its masqueraded abuse and corruption. What could freedom, equality, and fraternity still mean? What sense remained to family and homeland if their defense demanded the killing of so many? And what illusions lay behind morality and law, progress in science, philosophy and reason, when all that they could do was justify the unjustifiable or remain silent before the barbarity. Unquote.
Media. Free Radical Radio audiobooks. A John Zerzan feature. There have been some mildly hostile back and forthing between Jay-Z and one of the readers of Free Radical Radio in an email exchange that we get to know about but not see. This episode of Free Radical Radio features two Jay-Z-related clips. One is an 8-minute clip from the Anarchy Radio episode in which Adam Lanza called. You might remember that he is the elementary school shooter. And he called Jay-Z to talk about Travis the Chimp. The other clip is a 9-minute reading of an essay by Jay-Z called Second Best Life.
Sprout Distro, anarchist zines and pamphlets published in June of 2017. From sproutdistro.com, this announces that they've published a CrimeThink article on Rojava, the June 11th collection by and about anarchist prisoners, the Call for a Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, a prison newsletter, the June A-Tubes from A-News, the Illustrated Guide to Political Prisoners and Prisoners of War, and a collection from anarchists in Italy who are fighting the transatlantic pipeline.
Endless Space and Why We Can't Have Anarchist Strategy Games. From the Anarchist Geek website, written by Margaret Killjoy, who is known for interesting anarchist projects, including Steampunk Magazine, End Civ Journal, and the site Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, among many others. This is a review of a video game called Endless Space. Quote, I played a race called the Automatons, and of course I played it because one of their traits is anarchist. Anarchist, as a trait, means they aren't as good at piling lots of ships into big coordinated fleets because they have fewer, quote, command points, unquote. Which I got defensive about for a moment, then shrugged my shoulders and said, well, maybe, sure. We're actually pretty good at mobilizing large forces. We're just less good at, you know, having them operate under a single leader. Hierarchy might be better suited for the kind of command structure you're forced into with this kind of game, which is exactly my problem. Unquote. As with many of the reviews I enjoy the most, this points out underlying problems with the context, shows how things might be different, and then in a surprise ending, acknowledges reality.
Podcasts. TFS Radio, Confronting the Suit and Tie White Nationalists in Tennessee. An hour and a half. Many announcements, including the critical prison health issue of dirty water that they are not allowed to clean, and that causes a lethal illness. Sean Swain gives an example of psych treatment in prison, which, as you can imagine, fucking sucks, including for veterans. Given that mental illness is frequently criminalized, this is bad news for all of us. Burst does the interview in this episode with anti-racist action activists from Nashville who are organizing against a yearly Nazi conference called the American Renaissance Conference in Burns, Tennessee.
From Lazad with Love, 1 hour long. IGD interviews Final Straw producers William and Burst, mostly talking about their report back on the Anarchist Radio Show conference in Europe. Quote, "We discussed the conference, the wide variety of anarchist radio projects from South America to Europe that were represented, as well as the anarchist movement in Greece," unquote. A goal from the conference was to have a yearly conference hosted in different areas and an online 24-hour streaming platform hosting programs in multiple languages. Another proposed project has already been announced on ANews, called Bad News, a joint international audio and transcription program.
Anarchy Radio from July 11th, 2017. Always an hour. Kath and co-hosts. Hosts are excited about Hamburg and then move smoothly into talking about ITS, even though there's nothing to talk about there. Kath brings up snuff films as analogous to ITS. Jay-Z sounds like a Christian hyperventilating all over the terrible dirty things of pornography. They mention healthcare drama as a distraction from the technological drift of healthcare. Jay-Z continues his fatphobic slurs, says that the stories of killings are always his favorites, accuses the media of promoting stupidity because they're not anti-civ, and awkwardly chats with a couple of callers.
Topic of the week, fighting oppression. There seems to me to be two main ways that people come at fighting oppression. One way is to think about all the things that are similar, the same. I think Antifa is that style in practice, if not in theory. The other way is the style of, for example, Black Lives Matter, which takes a group of people with what many consider to be a primary identifying characteristic and organize around that. To look at these models with a critical eye, there are positive aspects to them too, of course. One of these smooshes everyone together to fight a lowest common denominator enemy, while the other is prone to competition between oppressed people, who has it worst, and also smooches together people who have little in common, but that's for a different point. Some anarchists are in line with one or both of these styles. Others reject the idea of fighting oppression at all, at least as is commonly understood, determining that as much evil has been done in the name of liberating people as in the name of capitalism, for example. What is a way to fight against people being treated badly that doesn't fall into the trap of treating everyone like they're the same as everyone else? Who has done a good job of recognizing individual autonomy while still addressing the categorical systemic problems of this society? Or is massing people together in groups necessary to make change? Insurrection from Italy seemed like it was starting to address some of this, but insurrection in the U.S. seems, at least from the outside, like it's taking on characteristics of leftism of the 60s. Good luck to us all. And I'm here today talking with Ariel, who's back after a little bit of a hiatus.
Hello.
Hello. So, fighting oppression.
This is an excellent question, the way it's worded. Yeah, it's... And a little depressing because the question about who has done a good job of recognizing individual autonomy while still addressing systemic problems, I'm kind of think the answer to that question is no one. And that was not what I expected the answer to be. But regardless, I'm getting ahead of myself. I come from a history of definitely... fighting oppression being the entire center of my politics when I was younger, mostly around women's issues. And then when I got to college, it was around Black issues, African-American issues, as the liberals at San Francisco State University called it. I didn't know that there was any other way. And thought that my frustration at feeling like these approaches didn't actually gain anything was me being short-sighted or even worse, just dumb. And so I think this makes this an incredibly difficult question for anarchists. And I think it should be a difficult question for anarchists because historically the examples that are held up as successful examples, absolutely.
So name one.
Desegregation of schools.
Okay. Why wasn't that a successful fighting of oppression?
There are lots of examples of private schools in this country that are predominantly Black, where students get far better educations than they do in public integrated school systems. Mm-hmm. Part of the program of desegregation was busing, which in lots of ways was a terrible experiment for every student involved. I was friends with someone whose mother desegregated a school. Mm. And it was such a traumatic experience for her that she would not talk about it. And she spent her entire existence as a mother not teaching her children that there was something particular about them being Black. Hmm. Because being Black had been so special for her. Hmm. So the person that I knew was her daughter, mm-hmm. who then found that there was this whole world of Black history and Black powerful women, and that she didn't know existed because her mother had intentionally kept this hidden from her because her mother wanted her to feel like she was like everybody else. Mm-hmm. Something like that. So it just wasn't such a clean cut, easy thing. But also more importantly for anarchists, all of that absolutely required you to negotiate and engage with the state on the state's terms. And of course involved the police and this intense apparatus of control and violence. And so these are complicated questions. And I think anarchists should treat them as complicated questions and be having complicated and detailed conversations about it. And we don't. I don't feel like we ever have for as long as I've been doing this.
Well, it's incredibly hard. I mean, I guess nowadays I'm spending a lot of time thinking about periodization, sort of in the context of like how one becomes like an adult or like how one matures over time or how one's ideas mature over time. In the first 10 years of someone's political life, someone's radical political life, if they choose a politic of the outsider, which of course anarchism is, mm-hmm. one speaks in abstractions, and the abstractions are as close to the truth or as close to real as one gets.
Sure.
So one spends a lot of time saying, I'm doing what I'm doing to fight oppression, to fight racial prejudice, which was one of the groups I was involved in, was against racial prejudice, and another one was against racists. Yes, right.
Right.
And it's only over time that you realize that perhaps I guess I'm speaking from being most of my quote-unquote organizing work being in that first category, mm-hmm. right? The one that smushes bad things together mm-hmm. rather than the second category that sort of speaks from a political position. But both perspectives are deeply embedded in what I now call, you know, in a sort of tongue-in-cheek manner, society. They're all consequences of the fact that we continue to think of a social body that's 300 million people large.
Sure.
And so when I think about fighting oppression in the context of this, I basically bring it down to, what do you feel about the civil rights laws? And of course, desegregation is a consequence of those civil rights laws. And you know, to what extent did this make an impact in your life? And what was that impact? And these are the ways in which bureaucrats and people who basically are on board with the political program that contains 300 million people, this is how they think. And I just, it just now as whatever, like 3 decades in, this doesn't feel like the right conversation for an anarchist to have. And that fighting oppression is just an abstraction that never can actually mean something tactile, something that actually I can bite my teeth into, something that is anything other than a sociology thing that I can talk about outside of myself, but that I myself am never going to have any control over. And it's all just a spectacularization of something that feels real. Because the other side of this is that most of my life, By any metric, I was an oppressed person.
Sure.
Or I guess most of my life, my young life was right. Like that. And so like, how does one, yeah, I guess for me, the where this falls apart is that I think that for most people, they're a lot closer to that sense of being an oppressed person and feeling like, how does one express themselves or enact themselves on the world as an oppressed person? And how does one think outside of these really stupid abstractions or these really paralyzing abstractions? And the number of people that get past both of those incredible barriers is a very small, very rarefied, and not politically powerful group of people.
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome. Welcome.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Huh. Yeah. We have talked before about using these big concepts to address the very particular things in our politic that we care about. And just the word, the concept of oppression feels like a trap to me sometimes.
Because it always involves an oppressor?
First of all, there's too much assumption. We, in defining what is oppressive and who is the oppressor and what is oppression, everyone has their own set of rules. And we
usually racial or economic.
Sure.
Or gender
or sexuality.
But those three are the big ones.
And age sometimes comes into play. Mm-hmm. And when we throw around oppression as a capital O word, we make the assumption that we all have the same set of rules.
I mean, I think what's important to state is that nowadays no one says the word oppression. They talk about intersectionality.
Oh, that's true.
Most people aren't oppressed along just one axis, right?
Right, right. And when you're talking about, so this is the same, it's complicated in the same way when you're talking about capitalism or you're talking about the state or you're talking about the military-industrial complex or how do you engage with something, making change, standing in the face of something that big, something that endemic in society, right? I am obsessed with the police gunning down young black men, you know, hunting them like game over the last, you know, particularly, let's say, 5 or 6 years.
I'm not sure that the numbers actually bear that out, but the media.
Sure, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
And the good-intentioned politicians who pay lip service to making change and their absolute inability to make any change because the problem isn't just that cops are killing black men. The problem is a society that accepts this as, there are these just rooted in endemic problems built over generations and centuries.
Sure.
And where do you find the core of that to start that conversation for even the people who want to change something and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that conversation starts.
Well, the conversation starts from people who have no power.
Always.
I mean, the problem with that argumentation is that it basically ends in where do we march, who do we march with, how do we sort of fight this fight in the same way that we fought for civil rights 40
right.
years ago,
right.
a fight that we can all agree, of course, that we won.
Of course.
Part of the problem with that story, of course, is I'm not quite so sure that we won much of anything at all, even though I was a 70s era beneficiary of that set of laws. You know, my mom's jobs as a single parent were definitely affirmative action jobs. And so it's again, like, I'm not sure the role of an anarchist is to say, how do we fix these problems? It's more to say, how do we make them so undeniable? Or like for instance, the way in which the intersection conversation is happening, is it saying I'm both a woman and of color, and and the complexity of that intersection is actually what makes something something, and that something something is just, as far as I can concerned, gobbledygook. In other words, per the lens of this articulation, if there are two different ways of fighting oppression, one which is to smush all the bad guys together, and the other is to unite with like-minded people or like-identified people, intersection is neither. And seems to only, the only tactic that it seems to have is call-out culture.
I have never seen a discussion about intersectionality play out outside of the anarchist world.
I think mostly it's playing out outside the anarchist world.
So I don't know what it looks like. I've never seen it play out satisfying to anyone in the anarchist
community. I think that's also true outside. The results of call-out culture tend to be both sides lose.
Yeah. And I gravitated towards the notion for a while, thinking, yes, there are particular things about being a biracial woman with a black father and light skin in this society, but I never felt like that got me anywhere better or different than I was already at before I started thinking about the breakdown and the relationships between them. The analysis wasn't better or more interesting. I didn't have a better plan of attack. I didn't have a different approach to the way that I was going to engage with the world or my politics or my oppressors or however you want to talk about it. So I guess in my head, in terms of my political position, I didn't live there for very long.
I mean, all I'm sort of hearing from what you're saying is that the strength of the civil rights movement and the strength of, frankly, Black Lives Matter is that if you want to engage in politics in this sick fucking society, you have to mob up. You have to do it basically by some version of numerical / powerful coagulation and then throw your weight around. Because what you're talking about is that the nuances basically disempowered you. Or that you didn't find power there.
I didn't find power there. I didn't think they disempowered me. But I didn't find power there. Yeah. I do absolutely think that if there is a field of play, and you want to be a player and be on it, you have to have weight. Yeah. And the only way that we have weight is through numbers.
We being the oppressed people.
We being a human being in an American society of 300 million.
Although ostensibly the other answer is to have money.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, ostensibly.
You're absolutely right. I just don't know those people, so I don't think about it that way. But you're absolutely right.
Well, and the you one
can, count, money is also weight.
Yeah, yeah. This is an interesting and hard problem because I guess I'm fundamentally unmotivated by the rhetorical flourishes that inform a lot of anarchism along the lines of that we're a movement that's on the cusp of taking power. When I sort of think through those that we would call oppressors are just, they're like running the field. They're doing every fucking thing they want to do. They're, you know, they aren't taking prisoners. They're just winning.
Yes.
And so to me, this conversation is very hard because fighting oppression in that context just means like losing slower, usually not even that, right? The direct people on the ground are the first ones in jail, right? They're the ones who lose the fastest, the soonest.
Yes, and lose the most.
So on that level, this is a depressing topic for me.
Yes.
I think that it is worth mentioning there is a little blurb at the end of this story that sort of talks about a distinction between insurrectionary anarchism from Italy and insurrectionary anarchism from the U.S., not exactly sure what the author's intent was, other than to say that insurrectionary anarchism in Italy seemed to be a critique of movement politics that were happening in Italy. So, in other words, there was the oppression of the state, but then there was also sort of nastiness happening within the movement itself, and insurrectionary anarchism in that context was a critique of sort of both sides. Whereas in the U.S., it seems like insurrectionary anarchism was born as much out of riot porn and fashion as it was about from an idea or a critique. And so so that especially as it's evolved to not necessarily be more intellectually engaged than it was when it started, that does seem to be a pretty significant tension between those two different definitions of insurrectionary anarchism. Is there anything else you want to ask?
No. This is depressing for me. I want to feel like I'm an anarchist who's fighting the good fight. And this just reminds me that
It's hard to find.
I'm not sure what it is. I'm not sure where to find it, and I'm not sure how to fight it. And
well, you know, I hope this week. I hope this week that the commenters actually tell us where the good fight is.
That'd be great.
Yeah, because so far though the options presented don't seem convincing.
They're a little lackluster. So find the good fight.
Thank you very much, Hero.
Thanks.
Weekly Anarchy 101 question and some answers. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org, a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. Most questions on the site have a lot of commentary that we don't read, but that commentary is at least half the fun. Question this week is, what do anarchists think or not of poverty? Do anarchists want to end it, or is it out of scope? I imagine views can differ according to the type of anarchism each one practices or likes. Answer number one. I think that poverty is caused by A, not allowing people to meet their own needs without the mediation of the market, and B, cultural hegemony that makes people think they're poor if they don't have the newest pair of Nikes, edit, or newest iPhone. I guess I'm using the word poverty not just in a we're hungry tonight way, but to mean we're hungry, but our neighbors aren't. And especially, we're hungry, but our neighbors aren't, and we're ashamed of that. Next answer. I will take a shot at answering the question as it was asked. This anarchist thinks the concept of poverty is a purely economic one, and I want no part of economic systems. It is economic systems, particularly capitalism, that have so ubiquitously defined what basic needs are, hence the list enumerated in the original question, which I find hugely problematic. Individuals have widely varying basic needs, even outside the context of economics and public relations, adds marketing. People are different, with different desires, different skills, different priorities, different levels of comprehension about what it means to live without institutional authority. If one lets go of ideas like security, equality, fairness, justice, which are rooted in dogmas that I want gone from my world, then you are left with the opportunity for a liberated life as a unique individual with unmediated, fully voluntary relationships. Nothing about that is utopian. Folks still need to figure shit out, including how to meet their basic needs. Nobody, or very, very few, will be able to do it on purely their own. Hence, relationships, authentic individual-to-individual, reciprocal, trusting relationships. Imagine that. If the answer being requested is one that systematically eliminates human suffering due to hunger, illness, etc., then you're asking for another system, or at minimum, a prescriptive program. This anarchist wants no part of any of that. Saving the world is simply not on my agenda, and in the world I would love to live in, that concept would be as meaningless as industry. Let the systems and institutions fall. Let the individuals that remain figure it out for themselves. Yes, there will still be human suffering and death. No big difference from the current world there. But here's a choice that I wish everyone had. Live in a world where institutions protect and provide, and destroy and lie and dot, dot, dot. Or live in a world where individuals and their relations do that for themselves. And the final answer. I, too, would like to separate the term poverty from the idea of having basic needs met. I agree that poverty is a relative position and often a subjective one. People often relate to themselves as poor or in poverty based on what they believe they should have access to. Sometimes that is food or wellness or shelter or internet or a new gadget or clean water or time off work or safety or whatever. A large part of that perception is the current social and economic system, placing a moral value on having. I.e., the system is fair and looking out for you, and anyone who plays the game and works hard enough will have what they want and need, and if you don't, you were personally culpable. There is an element of shame. Anarchy does not solve the problem of whether or not people will get their basic needs as they interpret them met, individually, in a chosen group, or as a larger social system. People will still be hungry and cold and sick and dying, and other people won't be. The idea that can change is our sense of entitlement, aka the idea of rights. Perhaps accepting that people and animals and plants and everything really experience times of lack and times of plenty, resource-wise, would remove some of the self-inflicted suffering related to things should be different from this. While it's a shitty, awful personal experience to feel bad, it is a very, very unavoidable one. The difference between now and anarchy is the why people suffer, lack, want, need, etc., and the distribution of that suffering, both among human social classes, groups, and human versus non-human species and ecosystems. As always, if you don't like these answers or have your own question to ask, visit anarchy101.org and join the conversation. Podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel, written by Jackie. The editorial was written by the collective member, produced and narrated by Chisel. Thanks to Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist material come from littleblackheart.com, and news and up-to-the-minute commentary from anarchistnews.org.